The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
Now on view at Skadfesh, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfesh.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Our region is known for its rich literary tradition, and today we'll learn about revival, lost Southern voices. The upcoming festival celebrates historically excluded, erased, or marginalized Southern voices. Plus, building reflections, contemplations in collage, an exhibition on view at the Callenwald Fine Arts Center explores the relationship between the built environment around us and who we've created ourselves to be. First, the Tony Award winner, multiple lifetime achievement honoree, boundary-breaking Broadway star, and hit recording artist Melba Moore has lit up stages in some of the most memorable performances of the 20th century. She's the first Black actress to star as Fantine in Les Miserables, and her recording of the Black national anthem, Lift Every Voice, occupies a place of honor in the congressional record as an American oral treasure. This year, Melba Moore has earned her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. She joins me now via Zoom to talk more about her dazzling legacy. Melba Moore, welcome to City Lights.
Well, thank you so very much for having me.
Oh, it's a thrill. Now, you are known and admired for your towering talent as a singer and actor, but you've said that your early success in acting actually came as a surprise to you and you hadn't trained for it. Would you talk about your earliest career dreams and what inspired you back then?
Well, my first occupation was a public school vocal music teacher in Newark, New Jersey. But I think what probably first inspired me was my mother was a professional singer. My natural father, whom she did not marry, was Teddy Hill, who ran Mittens Playhouse and was probably at least partially responsible for so many great, great artists coming in there and beginning the bebop jazz era. My stepfather, who married my mother, gave me a family because he had a son and a daughter. So I was an only child of an unwed mother before that. And I was living in New York City, Manhattan, but we moved to Newark, New Jersey. So I claimed them both. But I really claim what I feel is my family life to Newark, New Jersey. So I finished growing up there. I went to Arts High School. I went to Montclair Teachers College and I taught there. But my dream was always to be like my parents, to be performers. So after I taught public school in Newark for a couple of years, I asked my stepfather to take me to some of his colleagues to see if I could get into the industry. And he did. We made some rounds, but to make a long story a little shorter, one of the first people I met was Valerie Simpson. And somebody's publishing office or something. She hadn't sold all her big songs to Motown yet, and she was not yet married to Nick Asher. It was prior to all of that. We exchanged numbers while we were waiting for our meetings, and she got me involved in studio backup singing for recordings. And we backed up people like Johnny Mathis and Bobby Hebb. You probably don't even know who these people are.
I know who they are. Wow, big deal.
One of the recording sessions was for Galt McDermott. Now, he wrote the music for the Broadway show Hair, and they were still casting. And after a two-week session, they invited all of us to come down and sing for the producer and the director, and said that if we wanted to, they would make a place for us in the Broadway musical Hair, because they were really impressed with our singing, and they were still looking for strong singers. Well, that's how I got my first Broadway show. I got into the musical Hair. I stayed with it for a year or so, and the female leads kept leaving. So finally, one of the girls said, well, Melba, she's really strong. Why don't you give her a chance? I didn't even ask for the part myself, but they said, yeah, well, we'll try her out at one of the matinees, and if she works out, she can have the part. But the thing is, I got the part, but I wound up replacing Diane Keaton.
And I don't think you were singing backup after that, were you?
No, I was not.
Yeah, Hair was life-changing and, you know, moment-changing in American and British culture. At the time, how did you experience the values of free spirit that so many Americans were exploring?
I think I really embraced it. I was a little taken aback when I got into the show, and we were in rehearsals for the opening of the show. And then just prior to previews, they kind of commanded that everybody do the nude scene. I said, well, I didn't sign up for that. So they said, well, you don't have to do it. They didn't make it mandatory. And then after that, I got curious about it and I started doing it. I had never done any theater, hadn't studied any acting or anything. So I was hoping that, okay, you're going to get me in this production and I'm going to learn how to act on the stage. I didn't know I have to stand up naked. That was my concern. Well, I'm trying to learn how to talk.
Once you did, given the lighting and the singing, it really wasn't a big deal, was it? I mean, other than for the audience.
No. It's just I was shocked by it, and it got a lot of people to come to the opening because, out of curiosity. They probably thought there was going to be more to it, too,
yeah,
than just standing there for about 2 seconds and going.
Among your career milestones and firsts, in 1995, you started as the first Black actress to take the lead role of Fantine in Les Mis. You also were the first African-American to take over a Broadway role from a white actress when you were chosen to play Fantine. Please tell us more about that experience. It was a history-making performance, and I'm wondering what it meant to you and how it was received.
It meant everything to me because I realized that it wasn't R&B music. It really wasn't Broadway music. It was Les Mis, like a little operetta. It's almost semi-classical music. It's not an African experience. It's about the French Revolution. There was nothing normal about it. And for me to have been chosen for it, I knew that was extraordinary. But the thing I guess I took from it, but it's only on a personal level, but perhaps I've had some good experiences, because my perspective of things is it's a God-given gift and opportunity. And I thought, oh, this is a story about Jean Valjean who gets saved. That's the main story. And I'm not a very, very, very dark-skinned person, so maybe people wouldn't notice that I wasn't white. I don't know. And my natural singing voice is really classical or semi-classical, so I didn't have a problem adjusting to the kind of music that it was, but I realized it was a very, very extraordinary opportunity. I knew that. And I thought, oh my God, this is happening to me. I was so impressed with that opportunity.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes, and my guest is the acclaimed singer and Broadway legend, Melba Moore. You've described yourself as a born-again Catholic. It would seem that the embrace of any faith as a personal choice speaks to powerful emotions. What brought you back to religion later in life?
Losing everything, losing my daughter, losing my career, my family, my husband, being blackballed from the industry, having people think that I was a crack addict. I had never seen it. Just wondering, what was I going to do? I'm an artist. I'm not a manager. How do you recover from that? And I was just, I was homeless.
Oh my God.
It was devastating. I was just, I knew to call a certain amounts of TV and newspaper people to tell them what my situation was, mainly to make them understand I'm not a drug addict. This is not what happened to me. Figure out how to fight it in court when I had no money, no attorneys, but people lent me their attorneys and they helped me. But that came from crying out to God all the time.
It's the 1 year anniversary of your album, Imagine, which I learned was a family affair, executive produced by your daughter, Charlie Huggins, and her uncle, Bo. Would you tell us more about the making of Imagine and how your daughter helped inspire you to record it?
Well, of course, it was during the pandemic and we were all shut down. But I think one of the amazing things about it is that her uncle, Bo, is the brother of my ex-husband. So we were not together. We haven't spoken to each other maybe 20 years.
Wow.
That's a miracle right there. But, you know, you try to do anything for your children.
Yes.
And so I was able to put bygones beside her and listen to her and let her tell me. She said, well, Mom, you know, Uncle Bo and Daddy, they are the ones who gave you all of your successful records, so they know who you are as a recording artist. And she reminded me that she's of the now generation, so she could help me invent myself by helping to pick songs that she and her Uncle Bo and her dad would think were for me, but relevant now. And remind me that I might not be able to see that myself because I'm inside this little bubble. I can see myself from here, but not from there. So I wouldn't know how a newer generation might perceive me, and help me to listen to her and then go in the studio and try these songs and see what I thought and then see what some other people thought before we put it out.
She would not let you present yourself in any way other than your usual standard of excellence. The album represents for you a return to R&B after several years focused on gospel music. The singles So In Love and Imagine are two irresistible throwback slow jams, reminiscent of the late 80s and early 90s. Can you street? Oh, okay, we'll all be free. Imagine how pure this world could be. Yeah. What made you want to return to that style?
Well, I do it all the time. It's just I hadn't had a whole album out. I had several independent projects out. That's what's kept me working and kept me in front of different areas of the public. And as you can tell by the internet, everybody kind of has their own lane. So there are several different contemporary songwriters that write for me that have dance songs out. One of them very, very popular called Just Doing Me. You probably wouldn't know about that if you're in another lane of music that you prefer. Everybody's like in their own lane. So you don't know what somebody else is doing. It might seem like I haven't done anything for years if you're not in that lane, if that's not your kind of music, but I've kept it out and kept current so that I have a growing following that she could take advantage of with this album and continue to put music out and stay relevant.
This year, you're finally receiving your much-deserved Hollywood star on the Walk of Fame. What does that mean for you? Is it ever on your bucket list?
No.
A New Yorker and new, do you say a Newarker? Newarkian? What are people from Newark?
Newarker, or and I blame them both, New Yorker and Newark, or who I
Okay. Yeah. Do people in the New York area, in the Newark area, even think about the Hollywood Star Walk of Fame?
Absolutely, they do. They are most impressed with that. And to tell the story of occurring, I see how really powerful and important a gift that is to me in my life and my legacy and everything that I'm trying to do now. It enhances. People are really impressed with that. And I'm saying it like I didn't know it because I wasn't thinking about that. I never had that as a goal. And it's just a complete stunning surprise to me.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And totally well deserved. In 2022, you received some of the highest presidential honors at Morehouse College here in Atlanta, not just a Joseph R. Biden Lifetime Achievement Award, but also the President's Volunteer Service Award for your work and support with urban community improvement efforts. Would you share more about your involvement with these causes?
Well, I was raised by my parents to give back, and we would go and sing at nursing homes. I've gone to women's shelters, especially after I had the experience of being homeless. And I can usually get people's attention if they don't know who I am, if I sing a song. So I'll take my little boombox and sing something to them and just give a word of encouragement. So it's not necessarily, I got the award for urban community services, but I volunteer anytime I get a chance to. If you know somebody that wants a star to come and volunteer, tell them to call me. That's what I do.
Oh, how special. Now, I'm listening to you speak, and you sound like you could be half your age. I know you've said before that your voice only gets stronger as time goes by. What's next for you in music? Are there more recordings on the horizon?
There'll be more recordings, but primarily I think a live performances. I've been invited to participate in one of next year's Soul Train cruises. I'm going to be excited about that, but it's going to be almost a reunion because I'll be able to see my dear friends Stephanie Mills and Evelyn King and Kool and the Gang and Boyz II Men and Billy Ocean. And I'm a water bug. I like to swim. So I've been invited to come back to the UK, which has always been very supportive of me and my career. And American artists are very, very supportive. And I have some new dance tracks that are going to be released. One is called No Filter. And this is by a wonderful artist by the name of George Pettis. I said, well, George, what does that mean? It means you can see through you. You're transparent, no filter. But he writes really, really nice dance tracks and making appearances at some of the huge, huge, huge audiences that Club Quarantine's D Nice presents now. A lot of the people who used to be club DJs are now some of the concert promoters. Since they've, you know, been elevated, I get to work too.
Broadway legend Melba Moore. More information about her latest album, Imagine, is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, we'll piece together a conversation with the curator behind Callenwald's exhibition, Building Reflections, Contemplations in Collage, Amplifying Atlanta. This is WABE.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at ourgeorgiacoast.org.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for being here. The Atlanta Collage Society presents a new exhibition titled Building Reflections, Contemplations in Collage, exploring the relationship between the built environment around us and who we create ourselves to be. The show is on view at Kellenwald Fine Arts Center through April 13th. Curator Adam P. Faust joins me now via Zoom. Welcome to City Lights.
Thanks, Lois. I'm so excited to be here and looking forward to this conversation. Thank you for having me.
Oh, delighted to talk with you. Would you tell us more about why you titled this show Building Reflections?
Sure. So I'll go ahead and let the cat out of the bag from the start and say that I am a collage practitioner myself. And when I was thinking about this exhibition and knew that I wanted to work with the Collage Society, I thought a lot about what the process of making a collage is like and also where this exhibition is taking place. And oftentimes in my own practice, my favorite works are works that feel like something is reflected back to me that may or may not have been intentional, may or may not be a self-portrait, but that I see myself in the work somehow. And I thought of that process as building that image, because you have these pieces that you're layering and combining and transforming. And so the building came in there. And I was also thinking about, well, this site, this gallery is kind of a unique space in that it is in the Kellenwald Mansion, and that's a building. So let's throw in the mix collage's ability to take on multiple meanings and to change meanings of things. So I wanted to prompt the artist to consider the multiple interpretations of those title words, building reflections, and to kind of consider any or all of that in the works that they submit for the exhibition. So we have building as a noun, as a space that we inhabit, and we have it as a verb through our creative practices. And reflections, the same thing. We have a physical reflection, something, an image that's reflected back through us through water, glass, or a mirror. And also this process of contemplation and reminiscing. And I thought, what if we throw all of that in the mix and see how this really wide range of artists responds to that prompt. So, and it just sort of sounded poetic, and I proposed it to the Atlanta Collage Society, and they were into it. So that's what we went with, and I'm glad we did.
Well, I love the wordplay, and as you were first explaining, it dawned on me, oh yeah, building is both a noun and a verb here. And building is exactly what you do with various materials in collage. How does the theme of building reflections appear in the works of other artists in the show?
Sure. In this exhibition, we have a really wide range of interpretations. There's a lot of abstraction going on, and there's some literal reflections as well. There's artists who have used bits of mirrors in their works, and they have, you know, used old photos or old notes to kind of draw on that word reflections as well. And there's actual building materials involved in some of the pieces, you know, pieces of wood and hinges and things like that. And then There's people who have used photos of building materials from magazines and cut them up into, you know, paper scraps that they then layered and stacked and really built a three-dimensional surface out of the papers. I think it has shown its face in multiple ways in this exhibition.
Are there any outstanding works? Well, I imagine being the curator, you think they are all good.
Several, right?
Are there highlights you'd like to speak about in this exhibition?
Yeah, we had this exhibition juried, myself and another instructor at Callenwald, MB Andrews. We juried the show, and there's the Collage Society asked us to choose first prize and then two honorable mentions. And those are certainly highlights for me. But one of my favorite things that's happening in this exhibition is in one of the gallery rooms. For context, the gallery at Callenwald is upstairs in the mansion, and it consists of the main hall, a really large room, and then two smaller rooms, which used to function as bedrooms for the Candler family when they lived here. And in one of those rooms, we call it Studio A, there is a moment that's happening where on one wall, we have five pieces that to me are really true collage, and they reference the history of collage and the accessibility of collage. There's one piece that, you know, I've seen done in different workshops and things with children, you know, at elementary school. If you think of a collage activity in an art class at a school, there's an image that looks very similar to how collage would be approached from an educational standpoint of, let's gather all of our colors and the sky is blue, so let's gather all these blue scraps to make the sky and all these green scraps to make the ground. And there's a building that's been constructed in that image as well. So there's that piece, and then there's a piece that includes a lot of stitching. For me, collage, like the history of collage, is oftentimes attributed to Picasso and Braque as sort of folks who popularized collage in their art. But I like the version of collage history that gives a nod to craft and to traditionally domestic work, such as quilting. And that piece with the stitching in it, to me, really references that. And there's some collage that's consisted of just papers that the artist has painted and then rearranged. It's all of these forms of collage that feel very pure and very true to the history of the medium. And then on the opposite wall, there's one large piece by an artist named Inez Schmuck, who is more of a contemporary take on collage and showcases how collage can be used into what we know as sort of mixed media. And so on one wall, we have this history and this sort of nod to domestic and this sort of like interior space. And then reflecting on the other wall is where collage has gone and how collage is actually all around us in art everywhere.
Is that why you consider collage an inclusive art form?
I do. I think that collage is one of the most accessible art forms on my radar, at least, because the barrier to entry is really low. I can look around this desk right now and find a plethora of things that could make their way into a collage. I don't need to go out and buy a lot of, you know, expensive brushes or paints. If you are able to move pieces around, you're able to make a collage. And I think that accessibility is really important. And so far, as we see in this exhibition, there's artists who have been working in collage for, you know, 30 or 40 years or more. And it's just a really vast medium, and you don't have to worry about, you know, with drawing, it's like, am I rendering this image correctly? Does it look like what I'm trying to draw? But with collage, the pieces are right there in front of you. It's so tangible, and there's an immediacy in the actions that you take. You move something next to something else, and suddenly there's a synergy that happens and a feeling that comes with that. And you don't need to have gone to art school or to have a really solid foundation in design principles to be able to pull off a work of collage. And I think that's why you see it, you know, so commonly in art therapy practices and in arts education, you know, for people of all ages. And then you also have people who have really taken a really deep dive into it, and it, they kind of showcase what can happen when you really commit to a practice. And when you do have that foundation of design principles, you know, this exhibition has works that may inspire folks to get started on their own collage, and also just like stunning works that took hours and hours and hours. And I want to really create a synergy in this space around the arts. And I think that collage is the perfect way to kind of get that ball rolling and to get some ideas going in this space.
Curator Adam P. Faust, the exhibition Building Reflections, Contemplations in Collage is on view at the Kellenwald Fine Arts Center through April 13th. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. In a moment, a look at the upcoming literary festival Revival Lost Southern Voices. Amplifying Atlanta, this is 90.1 WABE. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. At a time when so many literary ideas are being threatened with erasure, there are those working to preserve voices so that they won't disappear. Revival, Lost Southern Voices, is an annual literary festival that celebrates historically excluded, erased, or marginalized Southern voices. Presenters discuss Southern authors or artists whose works are out of print or otherwise don't receive the attention they deserve. The festival will be held March 23rd through 25th. Joe Davich, executive director at the Georgia Center for the Book, writer Dawn Major, a lecturer on William Gay, and Gina Flowers, the director of Revival, join me now via Zoom to discuss this year's events. Welcome to City Light.
Thank you, Lois. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much, Lois.
Thank you.
Gina, please tell us about the history of the festival.
Well, it was a hot summer day at the 2016 Decatur Book Festival, a large independent book festival here in Georgia. And we do love our independent bookstores in Atlanta. While they were sitting there at the book festival, our Georgia State colleagues, Andy Rogers and Pearl McHaney, were discussing how they could continue to bring some of these lesser known or out of print authors back to the reading public again. And by spring 2017, poof, we had the very first Revival Lost Southern Voices. So that's a little bit of the history.
And how did the partnership with the Georgia Center for the Book and GSU Perimeter College come about?
Well, for the first 2 years, we hosted the event at Georgia State University Perimeter College campuses. And then we became more involved with Georgia Center for the Book. And as you probably know, they have a beautiful facility over there with a very nice auditorium and an upstairs space. And it just seemed like a really good fit. We share a lot of the same mission, and it was just a natural fit. And we're really excited to work with Joe Davidge and Allie Stonewright at the Georgia Center for the Book.
Joe, the event celebrates historically excluded, erased, or marginalized Southern voices, as we mentioned. Whose are these voices, and why is it important to preserve them?
Well, one of the missions of the Georgia Center for the Book, and actually all of the centers for the book across the United States, is to preserve the literary heritage of the state in which we've been chartered. What we have here in Georgia is a great opportunity, and I don't think most average Georgians know of the depth of authorship that we have here. Because authors have fallen out of print or maybe out of favor. But why it's important to revive these voices and to bring them back into common readership is that most of the ideas that are expressed in what they wrote about and in the times in which they wrote it are very prescient and relate so much to life and the struggles that we deal with today. You know, when you look at authors like Lillian Smith, who was talking about racism and this struggle for equality, and the fact that she was banned in Boston, and then summarily her book was banned across the country, you know, that's something that we're still facing today. And we still are arguing about book bans and what is appropriate in literature. So I think this kind of a festival really is not only something that we should undertake, but it is something that is still sorely needed.
Indeed. Gina, what will the lineup for this year look like?
Well, Joe is going to speak a little bit about the keynote address, so I'll let him do that. That happens on March 22nd. And then on Thursday and Friday, we have four virtual panels that happen at 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the 1 o'clock panel on Thursday is Appalachian Floodwaters. And that is going to be a team from the Hindman Settlement School and the Appalachian Writers Workshop. They are going to discuss how they are doing their recovery efforts to recover their archives after that catastrophic flooding in Kentucky back in July of 2022. Some of those pictures are just heart-wrenching. So that's the Thursday, 1 o'clock. The Thursday, 3 o'clock is a Lost Voices of Verse. So the moderator is Monica Weatherly, who is a Willie Morris award-winning poet herself. And those panelists will showcase poems of George O'Donnell, Sterling Brown, and George Scarborough, who may be some new names to some of your listeners. On Friday, our two panels are at 1 p.m. We have the moderator, Andy Rogers, who with Pearl McHaney co-founded Revival. And our GSU colleague, Brennan Collins, is going to highlight Raymond Andrews. His work you may be seeing on Broadway in the coming years. So that's a little hint on that. And then some other highlighted authors of that panel are Henry Dumas and Y.A. Two Moore. Friday at 3, we've got a panel of Tennessee-born writers. And Jim Clark will be speaking on and perhaps playing and singing a few of the mountain ballads collected by Mildred Hahn. Denton Loving will showcase George Scarborough, and Mickey Dubrow will highlight The Jew Store by Stella Superman, which, by the way, Dolly Parton purchased the movie rights to The Jew Store by Stella Superman. So you may be seeing that at some point also. So that's an intro to our virtual panels on Thursday and Friday.
Wow. If you are just tuning in, this is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes discussing the literary festival Revival, Lost Southern Voices with Gina Flowers, Dawn Major, and Joe Davidge. Dawn, leading up to the festival, the Decatur Library will house the exhibition Mystery Outside the Frame, the literary landscape of William Gay, displaying the art of the author and painter William Gay. Please give us a bit of background about him and his significance.
So William Gay was a Tennessee-born author. He was born into extreme poverty, and his parents were sharecroppers until his dad got a job at a wood mill in Hollenwald, where William, he ended up leaving when he went to enter the Navy, but he did return home to his hometown later on in life, and he remained there until he passed away. He was a voracious reader and learned pretty much at a very young age, once he was introduced to Thomas Wolfe, that he wanted this for himself. But they were so poor that he would use walnut shells, crush up walnut shells to like make ink. They didn't have access to that. He started painting when he got a paint-by-numbers kit, which is actually at the exhibition space. On one side, it was a clown. He, you know, and I always say he's the one not to follow rules. He turned it over and he painted a picture of a train on a trestle for his mother, which hung on her mantle until she passed away. As, you know, if ink wasn't affordable, then paints weren't really affordable either. But sometimes, because people knew that he enjoyed doing that, he would get Christmas presents with canvases and oil. So he writing was always going to be his first passion, but it was another way for him to express himself. And he would do that. And you can follow the years. The years a lot of times are written on the back because he would give his paintings as gifts. And so you can kind of follow the progression of his craft, and you can see it improving from cruder images to like more developed, like pastoral scenes. The things that he wrote about, he also painted.
It was while you were researching and writing your master's thesis on William Gay that you discovered a connection between Gay's prose and his paintings. What did you find?
Oh, this was fascinating. So I was writing my master's thesis, and I was really writing on supernaturalism. And then after I read his entire body of work, and we kept on going back to the same settings, I thought, well, this is really a world-building author, which is something new and significant to probably say about him. And I reached out to the archive, and one of the panelists, Michael White, will be on the panel on March 25th. He's the lead archivist. And I interviewed them, him and some of the other archive members. And I said, Michael, was there a map of, did he ever draw a map? Because it just seemed the way he wrote that he was one, like, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien or one of the C.S. Lewis, they would draw maps. And he was like, oh, sure, he has this map. And then I started looking at the map and reading his prose of, like, I was documenting, I was at that time more interested in mapping his fictional world against his real world. But then I started looking at the, you know, doing a real deep dive into the paintings and the prose and going, wait a second, he actually is like painting scenes and settings. And the real big aha moment for me was when I actually went up to Hollenwald to visit, because I wanted to take, one, I wanted to take pictures of the paintings, but I also wanted to take go around, meet the family, William Gay's family, and locate these places that I thought that he was writing about. And so the big, like my one of my most exciting moments, and this painting is Debye's Capstan and Pool Hall. It's in the exhibit now. And it probably isn't everybody's favorite because it's just a brick face of like a window, and it's nothing, it doesn't seem that special. But what was so special about it is this is a setting that he went to over and over and over again. And when I went to Hollenwald, I was talking to William's son Chris, and I said, why would such a little town have a pool hall? You know, well, it turns out it was a whiskey, you know, it was moonshine and, you know, illegal alcohol business that was staged as a cab stand, so they would make deliveries. And he said, oh, I think it's on South Maple. So I went there and I found that actual brick wall, but it was in the painting, there's some windows and doors, but you can see like in the photo that we're going to compare next to, then this will, some of the people that come to see the exhibit will be able to see this, where you can see that where the brick was filled in and the indentations were where the windows were. So that for me was like, oh, this is going beyond, you know, you're stepping. It felt like when I was in Hallwell, that was stepping into his narrative, into the places that he was writing about. And because he was so autobiographical, he was using real people, characters he knew from town, and real settings. It was sort of a merge of multiple little towns. So that's where the connection came. And then it just continued with putting together the exhibit, writing essays for different publishers, and just finding like these beautiful pieces of prose, and then reading it and having the ability, like the benefit of having to see this image. You feel like you're walking into the painting. It's almost like an immersive experience where you get to see what William saw in that scene, you know. And so I get real excited about it, as you can tell. I start talking faster and faster. I'm just so happy that this is here available for everybody to see. It's just a dream.
Great. Joe, what can you tell us about the keynote speaker and the topic that will kick off the event?
Well, this year's keynote will be given by Miriamma Graham, who's written a book called The House Where My Soul Lives, The Life of Margaret Walker. Margaret Walker was an author who wasn't from Georgia, but she did happen to write a novel in 1966 that was partially set in Georgia. And that novel is called Jubilee, which focuses on the story of a biracial character living during the American Civil War. And this character is based on Walker's great-grandmother. And this particular novel, Jubilee, was kind of the counterpoint to Gone with the Wind. It tells the story of the people of color living through the Civil War and through Reconstruction. So it's a very important book that I think that people need to be aware of. And Margaret Walker is an author that people also need to know her name, just as well as the name of other best-selling authors who wrote about this time period. Mm.
With the attack on Black and ethnic studies all over the country, and many books being banned now, there are many voices in danger of being lost. What can be done to preserve these voices nationwide?
It's a wonderful question, Lois. I think that what we need to do is to continue to uplift those voices. When you look around the literary landscape here of Georgia, we have so many authors who are working that represent that diversity. Georgia isn't what it was 30, 40, 60 years ago. And when you look at what's being published by authors of color about their stories, and I think that's what's important, is that we need to recognize that everyone has stories in the great landscape of our story as a people, but we simply can't push others' experiences, others' stories to the side, because it's not something that we want to be confronted with. We can't learn and we can't move forward if we don't have those discussions, no matter how painful they are. And you see some wonderful work by like Anjali Unjeti, by Daniel Black, by Teresa Davis, Alice Lovelace, wonderful poets, wonderful fiction writers, wonderful historians that are working. And it's because of them and bringing those conversations to the forefront that I think we as Georgians need to be very proud. And I think we as Georgians are leading this cause, not only with what we do with author presentations and poetry readings on a weekly basis, but with the Lost Southern Voices Festival.
Joe Davidge, the executive director at Georgia Center for the Book, and Dawn Major, writer and lecturer on William Gay. They were joined by festival director Gina Flowers. Revival, Lost Southern Voices, takes place March 23rd through 25th. The workshops are free and open to the public, but online registration is required. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Terminus Modern Ballet Theatre is offering free spring performances in Atlanta this week. On Thursday and Friday, the company will perform Peter and the Wolf on the Sifley Piazza of the Woodruff Arts Center. The dance is choreographed by Terminus co-founder Rachel Van Buskirk.
Peter and the Wolf is created in partnership with the Alliance Theater. This classic children's tale features Prokofiev's music, narration by the Alliance Theater, and our amazing Terminus dancers. The focus with this work is to engage our youngest art patrons in our community through interactions, movement prompts, and active storytelling. Sharing this story with our youngest patrons is pure joy. I love seeing them engage with the fine arts and know that they'll be tomorrow's artists, patrons, and art advocates.
Sunday's performance on the Great Lawn at the Atlanta Botanical Garden is Man in Black, choreographed by James Kudelka to music of Johnny Cash. Here's Terminus co-founder and artistic director John Welker.
It's a piece about celebrating American working class grit and perseverance. It's hard to think of another voice that is able to communicate that so effectively.
Tickets are free, but required for admission. For more information, visit terminusmbt.com. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., our series, The Art of Teaching, highlights GSU School of Film, Media, and Theater Professor Heath Franklin. If you missed part of today's show, like my earlier conversation with Broadway legend and renowned singer Melba Moore, you could catch up through our podcast or on our website, wabe.org/citylights. There you'll find a complete archive of our stories, so you can listen to City Lights on your schedule. City Lights senior producer is Kim Droves. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Etter, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.